podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Welcome to the Wisden Cricket Weekly podcast in association with Charles Tyrwhitt, who will be supporting the podcast in the build-up to the Ashes and across Wisden's coverage of the series. Often known for their stylish shirts, it's worth checking out their knitwear range, including crewnecks, v-necks and zipnecks, available in a variety of colours and perfect for wearing to the office or even when you're at home. During this period, we'll be offering a discount code for our listeners. If you use the code WISDEN20 at checkout, as the code suggests, you'll get 20% off your order. That's code WISDEN20. We'll provide the URL for that in the description of the pod.
Hello and welcome to the Wisden Cricket Weekly podcast. Yaz is away in Fort William this week. He's probably picked a decent week to be off, so I'll be hosting today, and I'm joined by former England captain Mark Butcher, Wisden Cricket Monthly magazine editor Joe Harmon, and Wisden.com feature editor Taha Hashim. Last week, we recorded an emergency podcast the day after Azim Rafiq's testimony to MPs at the DCMS committee, discussing his experience of racism and bullying at Yorkshire. Since then, there have been, well, lots of news stories, but two about Rafiq in particular. The first revealed him having made anti-Semitic remarks in private messages to another former cricketer, Atiq Javid, when he was 19, and for which Rafiq has apologised. And the second, published by the Yorkshire Post, alleged that after meeting and drinking with a 16-year-old girl on a plane in 2015, Rafiq texted her saying that he wanted to, quoting the texts, grab you, push you up against wall and kiss you. And after she said, do you realise I'm only 17? He responded saying, does that mean it's not allowed to want to kiss me? A spokesman for Rafiq said to the Yorkshire Post that this was put to us late on a Friday evening. We need to look into this, so I cannot comment further for now. And there has yet to be further comment from Rafiq or his team. Butch, what was your reaction to Rafiq's original testimony, and how, if at all, has that changed in light of the revelation since?
His testimony and the revelations within it don't change greatly. The things that have come out since, I was kind of waiting for it, really. People have perhaps intimated that Rafiq's own past is not whiter than white, and he's, which is an unfortunate turn of phrase, I understand. And he's held his hands up to sort of to a checkered past as a youngster as well. So, I mean, none of these things that wipe out, what he had to say. And I thought he was incredibly credible as a witness in front of the DCMS. I mean, it's not an easy thing to do, is sit in front of members of parliament and be cross-examined in that way. I mean, some people might say it was a relatively easy interview, I suppose. They were kind of rather allowing him without a great deal of cross-examination to make the claims that he did, but I thought he was incredibly credible, and the testimony he gave was at times horrendous. I've listened to a lot of stories like that in the last 12 months in the course of making the documentary that I made. All of it sort of would be shocking to the core if you're hearing it for the first time. For me, it was just sort of like a sad reiteration of things that I've heard from different players of different backgrounds about their experiences within cricket. I suppose one of the things that struck me about it was the particularly as it pertains to Yorkshire County Cricket Club, it shouldn't perhaps come as a great deal of a surprise that a county as recently as 1990, who had only just started to allow people who were born outside of that county, should have something of a difficulty in expecting people from elsewhere, no matter that they're, they might be of South Asian descent or West Indian descent or whatever else it might be. If you were from Derby, for goodness sake, you couldn't play for Yorkshire. And so the kind of the systemic side of it from their point of view perhaps shouldn't be such of a shock. The othering of people from other places is kind of inbuilt in their DNA in a way. That's not an excuse for Yorkshire, but it kind of explains quite a lot, I think, if you look at it from that point of view. His testimony also, I thought, was interesting in the fact that he was at pains to point out that making Making it about Michael Vaughan was the kind of was the most obvious and most striking one. Making it all about Michael kind of rather misses the point. And I sat there and I was nodding in agreement with him at that point as well, because my fear has always been, since the revelation, since people have been able to tell their stories and felt able to tell their stories about the racism that they have faced. All the while that was kind of blameless is not the right word. All the while that there weren't faces or there weren't fingers being pointed directly at individuals, it felt as though the message was getting through to the point where the wider community was beginning to understand that the words and the phraseology and the things that you say and the way that you behave towards certain people have a lasting effect on people throughout their lives. In some cases, it goes on for, you know, 30, 40 years after they'd retired. And that message was slowly seeping through. But then as soon as recriminations start, you know, he said this 10 years ago, she said that, whatever it might be, the sort of he said, she said, the back and forth of the accusations now against Rafiq, the accusations against, you know, somebody as prominent as Michael Vaughan, then all of a sudden that wider message disappears and it becomes a slanging match between one side and the other. And all that does is push both sides further apart when what you're trying to do is bring them together. It's been a heck of a mess, and I'm sorry if I've hogged the mic and rambled on a little bit, but there's been so many thoughts and so many, they're not conclusions, but so many ideas that have been thrown up by exactly what's happened in these last couple of weeks. And none of it's been particularly good for the game. I think Azeem Rafiq is, time will tell as to how this plays out. I think the cause for good is there because the organisations, and this is the most important thing, have understood and have realised that the wheels have to be put in motion. They have to be put in motion damn fast to not to clear up the reputation of cricket, because that's not what it's about. It's about actually doing something that makes these things better, that makes the abuse and the difficulty that people from different backgrounds have faced in getting into the sport, takes it away, removes it. It's not a PR exercise to clean up the reputation of the sport. It's an exercise to clean up and diversify the sport for real. And if Azeem Rafiq's testimony and Azeem Rafiq, this entire saga does anything, if it manages to go some way towards doing that, then all of it has been worth it.
Yeah, Taha, as Butch says, and as was a theme of Rafiq's testimony last week, and has been kind of a theme overall, that the focus should be on organisations rather than on individuals. And that goes as much for, you know, for Alex Hales or Michael Vaughan as it does for that Azeem Rafiq should also kind of not be the focus as well. So I guess as much as, I don't know, people's opinions of Rafiq might have changed in the past week, do you see those... What's come out since as having an impact, or do you think the ball is now in motion and that it kind of can't be stopped, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, whatever the complications of the man, or, you know, who's always claimed that he was far from perfect, I think the moment he sat down in front of those MPs and started talking, I think there was no going back from there. Whatever comes out about him, he set the ball rolling. You know, he's set English cricket on a path that he can't really reverse on now. We saw it last week when they had the game-wide meeting. They know they have to address this. And even today we're talking about, you know, even after everything that's come out with Rafiq, you know, Jahid Ahmed, who, a former Essex cricketer, he's opened up to the cricketer and talked about his experiences. And he, you know, he's quoted saying that, you know, this is why what Azeem Rafiq has done is so important. It's opened our eyes. It's inspired us. And he, you know, he cites Rafiq as the reason he's talking now. He's kind of set English cricket on the path. So it's, and I think that stems from what happened 7 days ago in front of that DCMS hearing.
Yeah. Well, in regards to the first of those stories, I spoke to Jewish News web editor Jack Mendel, who interviewed Rafiq on Friday morning after the story about the anti-Semitic texts broke. Hi, Jack. I'm sure you were moved, as we all were, by Rafiq's testimony last week. What was your reaction then when you saw this story showing that he'd indulged in, I guess, the type of behaviour that he'd spoken out so strongly against?
I think my initial reaction was concern that it might undermine the whistleblowing and the overall cause of rooting out racism in cricket. As a cricket fan, you know, it's very close to my heart. And I think it's fair to say my worlds have very much collided in the last few weeks. So to see this story emerge was very concerning. I think Rafiq's testimony, you could hear in his voice that it really got to him. It was very personal. And I think that there's a certain sincerity that comes with that. And when I spoke to him last week, there was absolutely no attempt whatsoever to caveat his apology or make excuses. It was a complete hands up. I'm in the wrong and I deserve everything that I get. But also he showed a willingness to want to educate himself. And since he's been in contact with various Jewish community leaders, and I've even had a number of requests to put him in touch with people. There is a will to learn from his mistake and to show that he doesn't want to lend any kind of credibility to his prior comments. He wants to show that he's a different person.
Yeah, and I guess that's what's kind of been key in a theme running through this, is that it's not about sort of ostracizing people who have, you know, made comments that are obviously wrong. It's about learning and apologizing and moving forward, I guess.
Yeah, definitely. I think there is a principle within Rafiq's whistleblowing in general that it's not about individuals. Even when Michael Vaughan came out and denied it, Rafiq said in his testimony he doesn't want to make it about Michael Vaughan. And it's the same with his own anti-Semitic comments. It shouldn't really be about the individual. We have to try and separate people's past indiscretions from what has emerged from the whistleblowing. And we saw yesterday that more than 30 people have already come forward to the email address saying that they've experienced racism. So this has clearly had an impact. And, you know, nobody's perfect. People have said things in the past that they might regret. It shouldn't really deter cricket from making progress in tackling this institutional problem.
I guess that's the thing, and whatever you might, if people's opinions have changed of Rafiq in light of the couple of stories that have come out, they still show that there's more racism in cricket, not less, I guess. I was wondering, moving slightly away from Rafiq, I suppose, it's often suggested that anti-Semitism is received differently and less severely than other types of racism. Did you feel that was the case with this news and with the reaction to it, not just from Rafiq, but from others, I suppose?
It's a difficult question to answer, mainly because there isn't a huge amount of anti-Semitism in cricket. And that's largely down to the fact that there are barely any Jews that play professional cricket. I can think of one off the top of my head. So it's difficult to address the issue when it doesn't really rear its head that often. I think Rafiq's response was very important because it showed how seriously he took the issue. I think it was interesting that this news came out amid other forms of racism also coming out. And I don't think it was treated differently. I think within the Jewish community leaders have supported Rafiq. They said that they supported his testimony and they also accepted his apology. So I think that this has been seen as part of a wider bid to tackle racism in the sport. I don't think that it's been seen as less important or different per se.
Yeah, okay. So you wrote a piece for Times of Israel, and you referenced that earlier in this whole case, Yorkshire coach Andrew Gale was suspended for an historical tweet in which he'd used an anti-Semitic slur. We've sort of discussed and we discuss now that sort of this is about sort of moving forward and kind of making the game more inclusive. Is there stuff that can be done kind of at all levels of cricket to make cricket more open to the Jewish community?
I think there is. And what Rafiq said when I interviewed him last week was that he'd never had a Jewish teammate. He'd never really integrated with the Jewish community. He didn't know any Jewish people. And if you don't know any people from a certain community, you're not likely to know the contours of what's offensive or cultural norms, that kind of thing. And I think you see in football, especially, a lot of clubs will do work with different communities to try and educate fans and players alike about their fan base. And cricket needs to have that conversation, especially in Yorkshire, which has a huge South Asian community. It needs to reflect that community better, and part of that is education.
Yeah, and you're a keen club cricketer yourself, but is it not something that you've experienced too much at that level? Or
I'd say the only time I've experienced anti-Semitism at club level has been at university, when people used to say, "Don't be Jewish with the T's," that kind of thing. And yeah, it is largely from ignorance. Comments like that at university and in other clubs up and down the country are largely from ignorance. The problem is, you don't want to be the person that gets the university cricket team suspended. You don't want to be the person that gets them into trouble. And that's why a lot of the time people won't say anything, or they'll have a quiet word with one person. But if it's a cultural problem, then it needs to be addressed on a much higher level. It needs to be addressed on a club level, for example. My own experience of playing club cricket in North London is I've never had a problem. I've played against teams that have provided us kosher teas before. We didn't even ask for it, but they saw we were a Jewish club and they thought, let's provide a kosher tea. I think by and large in North London, it's not a problem to be a Jewish cricketer. I'm sure there's other forms of racism. I'm sure there's other forms of discrimination that takes place that perhaps isn't spoken about as much. And especially if you look at Middlesex and Surrey, there are really not that many cricketers from ethnic minority backgrounds. I think there's a big conversation in London about getting cricketers from ethnic minority communities into top flight cricket and eventually into the England team as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thanks so much for your time, Jack. It's been great to speak to you. There's been a bit of sort of murmuring about the two stories about Rafiq, that it's been kind of some sort of smear campaign or like a concerted effort to discredit him, which personally I don't really buy into. I think both are definitely legitimate news stories with public interests. And there have been questions raised over the Yorkshire Post's reporting of Rafiq's claims and the whole story kind of throughout, the kind of given almost like a lack of prominence to the things. There was one of their correspondents was in a sort of back and forth with Rafiq on Twitter that was a bit sort of unbecoming. But I also see how when someone gains more prominence than they've had before, that's when people are likely to realise their interactions with those people become important and newsworthy. And I also say that on the second story, English cricket obviously has a problem with racism, but it clearly also has a problem with misogyny. I mean, if you think back to Alex Hepburn's rape conviction and the horrific details that emerged during that trial about the dressing room culture at Worcestershire, which you'd imagine isn't entirely unique to that club, that if this can spark a conversation around that too, then that is a positive. I don't know, Joe, do you have anything to contribute on anything? I mean, it's hard to make heads or tails of, really, but it's a...
Well, I know the Yorkshire Post and Rafiq have had kind of an ongoing argument, essentially. And I know the Yorkshire Post ran an apology after his appearance, saying they haven't reported it correctly, basically. That said, we don't know how the story of the young girl at the time who came to the Yorkshire Post, whether that was dug out or whether she saw the testimony and thought, this is not a man representing himself fairly, and therefore went to the Yorkshire Post. As soon as the Yorkshire Post have that story, they have to run it. I don't think they had any choice but to do so. They would have been aware that they were putting their head above the parapet again, having already been criticised for not giving Rafiq's story enough credence. And the unfortunate effect is that there will be those who feel that those stories completely undermine what Rafiq said and his allegations. I think those people are in the minority. I think the whole thing has moved on quickly, and this has always been much bigger than than one man. He wasn't in facing the DCMS select committee because he was racially abused. If that happened to every sports person who was racially abused, they'd be extremely busy. He was there because of how Yorkshire handled it, and the attempt to cover it up and forget about it. So I think whatever comes out, and you know, there might be more stuff in the next days and weeks. There certainly will be about other cricketers, even if it's not Rafiq. And there'll be a lot of cricketers who are worried out there about what's going to come next. But I still don't think that halts the progress that's been made over the last couple of weeks, couple of months. At least I hope not. I just don't see. I think there's been too much momentum. There's too much focus on the ECB. There's too much focus on Yorkshire for everyone just to go back to what they were doing previously.
I think one of the interesting parts of all of this is that, you know, thinking about sort of Michael Vaughan. Now, Michael Vaughan's a lot of things. You know, he takes the sort of the Piers Morgan light Twitter personality thing much too far for somebody with the reputation that he has or should have had as being the Ashes winning captain in 2005, and can make a bit of a plonker of himself on there from time to time. But I played with him with and against him for the best part of 15 years, and he's a lot of things, but he's not a racist in my view. Now, there's a very good chance, and again, I go back to Rafiq's testimony, there's a very good chance that guys would say things around players, you know, minority players playing for Yorkshire, and not even realise they were doing it, so ingrained was it in their culture that why would they remember saying stuff like that? And he might well have said it. I might well have said something to somebody at some point in my career. I don't know. I doubt it, but it's possible. And if every utterance that people make in a dressing room or pitch side scenario becomes something that you can potentially lose your job over, then there aren't going to be very many cricketers left. Again, none of this is excusing anything, but I think that the focus needs to stay on the organisations. It needs to stay on the changing of the infrastructure around where people come from to play the game, what backgrounds they have, how many obstacles are placed in their way in order to perhaps fulfil their dreams of becoming professional cricketers or even just playing club cricket. I mean, crikey, if you think that that the professional game is the sort of the pinnacle, yes, and where the spotlight is going to be shined the fiercest, imagine what it's like further down the ranks in clubs up and down the country and how difficult it can be for players trying to break in there. That is where the change from what Azeem Rafiq has brought about will be felt most keenly. It isn't going to be felt by popping your teammates over things that they'd forgotten saying 12 years ago. That's just and because what happens from that is you end up with this back and forth, this ridiculous claim and counterclaim. You're morally corrupt. You're morally corrupt. You did this. You said that. And in the end of it, none of it can be proven, and none of it does anything but create animosity, and creates a situation where people are trying to discredit people's heartfelt witness testimony about things that hopefully will bring some change later on. This is about making things change in the future. It's not about destroying people from the past. And Azeem Rafiq now knows that himself, because he's had to stand there and hold his hands up.
Yeah, well, as you're entirely right, and this what we discussed a lot, that the focus needs to be away from individuals. I think we do have a sort of a duty to round up the stuff that's come out. So I'll just do that quickly, and then we can move on to the general discussion. So Alex Hales has denied there was any racial connotation in the naming of his dog Kevin, but has apologised for attending a fancy dress party in 2009 in blackface. His apology included the line, the theme was musicians and Tupac is, was, and always will be my favourite musician, so I went as him, which is a slightly surreal line for an apology to include. Brezen has denied that he frequently made racist comments to Rafiq, which is what Rafiq alleged in his written evidence to a Leeds Employment Tribunal, which was made public following the DCMS hearing. Jack Brooks has apologised for using racist language in tweets from 2012, and two more cricketers, as Taha mentioned, Zoeb Sharif and Jahid Ahmed, have spoken out about racist abuse they received while at Essex. Ahmed described it as a white man's world where brown people were outsiders in an interview with the cricketer. There was also the news that 36 people have emailed Yorkshire's whistleblowing email address since it was set up just over a week ago, which is a lot of people, isn't it, Taha?
Yeah, it's weird because you don't want to hear that in a way, but it's also a positive. It kind of shows that, like we said earlier, that the ball's kind of, you know, it's been set. It's the path is there now, and people are hopefully going to open up about their experiences. We're seeing it at Essex. We've seen it at Yorkshire. We're going to continue to see it. There's just no going back, basically.
Yeah, as Taha mentioned, the ECB had a game-wide meeting. I'm not sure any of us were invited, but there you go. Last Friday, which culminates in releasing one of those statements that kind of just makes people roll their eyes a bit. From the looks of things, there have been reports of a 12-point action plan that just wasn't ready to be finalised. This was kind of supposed to be a holding statement, and there is sort of more substance coming. But they just aren't especially good at that sort of... For an organisation which is so obsessed almost with the PR side of things and how they put themselves, they're not that good at it, are they, Joe?
I mean, we've become slightly used to these kind of statements from ECB, but when you're covering such serious subject matter, they really, really fall very, very flat. It definitely smacked of kind of groupthink with no one knowing quite what they thought. So it seemed like everyone had their bit in there. And it was extraordinarily long statements, say absolutely nothing whatsoever, to the point where actually you felt like maybe they should just stick a paragraph. If they've really got nothing to say, just stick a paragraph out and say we'll have more next week, rather than kind of going round and round the houses until you get to the point you realise they're not going to tell you anything. And that was widely reflected in the reaction across the media, who I think were flabbergasted after the week that they'd had. To see this as the limp thing that rounds off the week was quite extraordinary.
It was kind of one of those statements where it's like, I've seen this all before, and you kind of almost, you're second guessing yourself as to like what actually happened this week, because this is the kind of statement I would have expected a few months ago, a couple of years ago, where everyone just says, yeah, we're going to unite against racism. And it's like, were you not in the room a few days ago? Did you not see what happened? It's like, if you're, you're not going to say anything kind of meaningful. I mean,
I do have some sympathy, given the amount of different kind of parts of the game that were involved in those discussions. To come up with anything meaningful in the time they had, it was always going to be
true,
anything
they
came out with was probably not going to be accurate or thought through. But I think people would have respected it more if you just said, look, basically, we're not quite ready yet, rather than pretending that huge developments have been made, but we can't quite tell you yet.
The lesson is, don't PR stuff. Don't PR stuff. This is not a PR-able event. You know, be 100% straight and honest. And even if that is the honesty is around, listen, we've not been able to assimilate this yet. We really haven't got a clue what we're going to do yet in order to solve this issue. The issue is too big. It's too ingrained for us to be able to sort out over the course of a 2.5-hour meeting in the afternoon. Say that.
It's exactly right. I mean, obviously they can't solve racism over sandwiches at the Oval in one day. And you're right that if the statement's just been shorter, I'm just going to pick out one paragraph, which I think... So it's just... So because most of it is fine, you know, it's an apology to Rafiq, we'll publish some actions next week. But then there's one paragraph in the middle which just, we stand together against discrimination in all its forms, are united as a sport to act. We will continue to listen and make swift, positive changes to the culture of the game. We will embrace and celebrate difference everywhere, knowing that with diversity, we are stronger. I think just remove that paragraph and it becomes a perfectly fine holding statement. But you have that
I think that was Tom Harrison's paragraph right there. That was the bit he was, get this in. I've got some good stuff.
But I mean, the thing is, you can't... The word swift is just... It's kind of a lie, isn't it? It's a lie. Because you can't do anything that fast. You can apologise very quickly. I mean, you know, if there's been one lesson learned by everybody involved in this, is that a heartfelt, non-PR'd apology immediately goes a hell of a long way. Again, Rafiq said that himself. I accepted. Matthew Hoggart called me. I accepted his apology. Fine. Job done. If Yorkshire had found it within themselves, however long ago it was, to have held the hands up and said, you know what, we've had a nightmare here, we wouldn't be where we are right now. And maybe that's a good thing that they didn't do that, and maybe it's a good thing that we've got to this point. I still can't help but thinking that the little bit of introspection, a little bit of self-reflection, being able to hold your hands up to a mistake, which seems to be the most difficult thing in the world to do in this modern time we find ourselves in. things would be a damn sight better than they are, and people could go about doing the things rather than talking about them, making statements about going about doing the things that will actually make some sort of a difference. But to say anything is going to be done swiftly is you know, it's just nonsense. It can't be. But making people aware that this will no longer be tolerated in any form, you know, is the beginning point. And then you prove it by action, not by PR statements.
Yeah, I think part of the press dissatisfaction with that statement was that there had been reports leading up to the meeting that that would be where the county chief execs and chairs, whatever, would sort of come together and kind of call for Tom Harrison to go. And it seems as if he's bought himself a little bit more time, perhaps, in that meeting. And then when that happens, you can't really statement saying, like, Tom Harrison's like, he can't put out a vote of confidence in himself. So I think that was also, and then, you know, you had the press gathering at the Oval to then hear this statement
who's going to want to step into that breach right now anyway? You know what I mean? He'd talk about him buying himself some time, but
decent bonuses.
At the moment it's come on, we shove him out the door and he can deal with it for the moment, and you wait sort of Caesar style in the background for the time when it's a little bit more opportune, perhaps.
Well, those haven't got a chairman as well at the moment, have they? I mean, you can't all leave at the same time. I don't think Harrison's position is long term is tenable, but I don't think the time is right to go now. I think English cricket needs someone in that position.
Yeah. Anyway, on that plan, while there's been reports of what's contained within it, I think it's best to discuss it when it's published and finalised. So tune into a later episode for that. The other big story of the week is Tim Payne's resignation as Test captain is following the emergence of an investigation into sex and explicit images he sent to a Cricket Tasmania colleague in 2017 on the eve of his Test comeback in that winter's Ashes. That investigation, which took place in the middle of 2018, cleared him of breaching Cricket Australia's code of conduct and concluded that the exchange was consensual, though the woman that Payne was texting alleges that the image, at least, wasn't solicited. Mark, this feels like a scandal that wouldn't bring down quite a lot of politicians. can you explain why Payne had to go?
Well, if you think about the circumstances under which he was brought into Captain Australia, that gives you all of the entire answer right there. Steve Smith stripped of the captaincy in disgrace after the ball tampering episode, banned for however long he was. I mean, they went so over the top there that it was almost comical. But Tim Payne comes in as a sort of, you know, an unremarkable cricketer, really, by Australian standards anyway, to come in and captain the team because he was supposed to come in and be this moral beacon, leading Australia and their elite honesty and all the rest of it to the promised land. And of course, he said that happened about during the same month that he was made Australian captain to do all of these things. That was what was going on in the background. So that's why he's had to go, I guess. It's because the sort of, not the hypocrisy of Tim Payne or the hypocrisy of his appointment. It's nothing to do with him, really. It's to do with the way that Cricket Australia has kind of tried to set itself up as this, again, as this, I used the words moral beacon a few seconds ago, but that's kind of what it is. And you know, they come crashing down to earth just as hard as everybody else has.
Yeah, there's been a reasonable amount of disquiet in Australia over Payne's exit, with David Peaver, who was CHO at the time of the investigation, criticising the current administration for effectively going against their conclusion at the time, and with the Australia Cricket Association and Cricket Tasmania also criticising CA's handling of it. This feels more like the story is about CA mismanagement and pinning the blame on players in a way than it is about Payne itself, do you think? Like, is the story more the cover-up rather than the original thing, do you think?
Well, yeah, I mean, what's kind of interested me more out of all this is kind of the sort of internal Australian cricket politics, because, I mean, Cricket Tasmania, I think today the statement's come out where they've, you know, is that Tim Payne's been treated appallingly. There's a statement that says, Cricket Tasmania chair Andrew Gaggin, who says, in conversations I've had in recent days, it's clear that the anger amongst the Tasmanian cricket community and general public is palpable. So that's quite a punchy statement from a state association in regards to conduct by Cricket Australia. So it's
You know, one thing it's done though, it's stopped Cricket Australia from having to remove him for not being good enough to be in the team.
But then the other thing is
that might actually have done Australia a favour in the long run.
But the reports seem to suggest that he is going to be in the team, that he's not going to captain. So and if that is the case, they found themselves in a bizarre situation because the only reason he was in the team was because he was this leader. But it seems like the indiscretion has been deemed too serious to be Australian captain, but not serious enough to sack someone from the team altogether. So you're ending up in this kind of bizarre limbo where, I mean, I've not been Tim Payne's biggest fan, really. But I do feel sorry for him. I think the framework around this kind of this unimpeachable leader, kind of captain Australia, who's going to rid Australian cricket of all evil, is not really his fault. I do think at times he's played up to it. I think he's perhaps got caught up in the whole thing himself. But I don't take any pleasure from his kind of demise. And I think it's going to be quite a miserable... I mean, he's saying, what, to go out on a high winning the Ashes? Well yeah, but that you're kidding yourself, really, if that's how you think it's going to be remembered. Payne has acknowledged that on a couple of occasions this story has come up. He's thought it's going to be published, and he's basically been kind of living in fear and anxiety that this will all come up at some point, which, again, slightly begs the question. I'm surprised that he's continued in the role as long as he has. And obviously, look, I completely understand it's tough to resign being Australia captain, and that would have created some interest in itself. And he obviously didn't want to let the position go. But it does, just from a personal point of view, he can't have been having much fun over the last couple of years if this is what he thought was going to come out at some point and his career was going to come crashing down around him.
So they're either very serious or they're not. There's no sort of middle ground with this. It's either a very serious thing to do to send pictures of your private parts to a female member of staff in your team, or it's not. There's no sort of, oh, well, you know, maybe this is okay. Been kicked into the long grass until now, 4 years later, 5 years later, which I'm not making any judgment on that. I'm just saying it's interesting.
So, Joe, you mentioned that you haven't been Tim Payne's biggest fan. What do you think will be his legacy as Australia Test captain? Because, you know, before this, as you said, I think he'd been seen quite differently on different sides of the world, where we sort of look at this guy and think, why is he in the team? Australia fans look and think, like, this is the guy that kind of rescued us after ball tampering scandal. How much has that been diminished, I guess, by what's happened now as well?
I mean, at the moment, it feels like it's been diminished hugely. I do think as time goes by and his kind of tenure is reflected upon, I think it will be largely looked upon quite positively, and certainly a bloke who got given the job. I mean, I think everyone knows he would have never got this job if it wasn't for Sandpapergate. In no other circumstances was he going to end up being Australian captain. And that's a difficult position to be in. He would know that he, on balance, probably doesn't deserve his place in the side. He's been trying to keep a kind of fractured team together at times. And they've come out of it okay, really. He's done all right. I mean, I think he's not a test batter as such. He's underperformed in that sense. But he'll be remembered as a captain. And his name will always be, I think, will much be remembered more to do with Sandpapergate than what's happened over the last couple of weeks. In the sense that, and I suppose there is still an opportunity, if he is indeed going to be picked in the side, which does seem odd, you know, he could go out and score some runs, he could go out and win an Ashes, he can actually play a leading role in that. There is still a chance for him to kind of alter his kind of legacy to an extent. But yeah, we haven't talked about who will be the next Australian captain.
Well, I mean, that's quite important. We're coming to that, but yeah.
I was just going to say, it's be interesting to see if they don't pick him, is that basically an admission that this guy was just in our team because he was our captain?
Well, I think that's why Australia almost feel they will have to pick him, because otherwise it is an admission that they've held the line, which a lot of people haven't believed, that this guy is
the best clubman in the country.
Exactly.
He's the best option there. And he's not done terribly, really. An average of, what, 32-something as a keeper? That's, you know, that's okay.
It's about what Josh Butler averages, yeah.
I do think it's probably overstating it to say he rescued Australian cricket after Sandpapergate. This is still a test side that has lost two series at home in the last few years. Sure, they regained the Ashes here, but that England team wasn't anything spectacular, and they drew that series 2-2. So, you know, I wouldn't say that he was the saving grace of Australian cricket.
So Pat Cummins looks likely to be the front runner to take over. Butch, fast bowlers aren't usually considered seriously for captaincy positions. And that seems to kind of be the only argument against Cummins. It's been kind of amusing to see him being sort of canonized as this like a, you know, saintly, amazing individual. And that was kind of exactly the issue last time.
Yeah, don't do that.
Yeah. But why is it an issue for a fast bowler to be a captain of a cricket team?
Why? I mean, well, simply because fast bowling is such bloody hard work, physically, and mentally as well. But sort of if you couple the two things in a way, as a fast bowler that you don't really have to deal with as a batter or even a spin bowler. Not that there have been many of them. And the other issue is, of course, you know, injury. You don't rotate batters, do you, in and out of teams, generally, much to the chagrin all of the fast bowling fraternity. It's always the bowlers that kind of end up sitting out the odd test match here and there. And of course, if you make he's an incredible bowler. If you make one of your best quicks skipper of the side, then he has to play every game, pretty much. Right? You're saying he's playing every single game. So you've got a five-match series, he's not going to miss one. And we've already, this Ashes series is condensed in a way that very few have been in the past, and you're thinking, well, you're not going to make five tests. You're just not. I mean, depending on how England bat, I guess. But you know, you're not going to make five test matches as a fast bowler, at least not without the real risk of injury or just, you know, being not being able to perform at your very best. So that's why. In terms of his credentials as a cricket brain and all the rest of it, I don't know. I have no idea. You know, I don't know that they obviously think that there's something there in terms of a leader of men. And that's all good. But, you know, it's bloody difficult as a fast bowler to do it. Bob Willis really struggled. He's the only England player I can think of who's Stuart Broad did it as in the T20 game. So you don't have the same physical demands there.
Lemon in his piece for The Guardian said that Ray Limwell did it once and that's it for Australian fast bowlers leading there. But then it also becomes a self-perpetuating thing, doesn't it? That there's just that belief that,
they can't do it.
They just don't do it.
Yeah, I mean, he might be the first one to make a real good fist of it. But the thing is, Brisbane or whatever, hot day, England back unbelievably well. He's in his fifth spell or something and suddenly goes in the back and you're looking for a new captain. Do you know what I mean? It's much...
You're more likely
to miss matches as a fast bowler than you are doing any other job in the game of cricket.
Yeah, I guess the only thing is that players now do just seem like they miss more test match than they used to, and it's not as much of an issue. Like, you know, Root missed a test match last summer as in 2020 summer, and that wasn't a huge issue. Stokes stepped in. Kohli, you know, misses a fair few tests, and you know, missed a few for the birth of his child, has rested for the first game of the New Zealand series. And
yeah, but that's very different from missing a game because you've ripped your hamstring off the bone or something. That's kind of that's taking sort of leave of absence that's been planned perhaps or for whatever reason. That can happen, you know, as a fast bowler, and of course playing professional sport, anybody can get injured at any time, but your likelihood of getting an unexpected long-term injury is I would say 75% higher as a fast bowler than it is as a number four, number five middle order batter. I mean, that's just a fact.
What's interesting as well is that we talk about these guys who did it briefly as fast bowler, that Willis, you know, Linwall, and Cummins is in the age of playing three formats. He's a key part of that T20 World Cup win as well. So the thing with him is you're just not going to see him play that many. If he does become captain, he's just not going to play that much white ball cricket, is he? They're going to have to rest him.
Yeah, but then I guess Australia are kind of fine with doing that.
They are kind of fine doing that and then just playing him in the big tournament, basically.
I get the sense that you two are very, very keen to see this work. You asked me why it doesn't happen very often. I just told you why it doesn't happen very often. He might go on to do it forever and everything will be
fine. Importantly, what are the other options they've got here? Steve Smith is quite a kind of tantalising one
The thing that I do not understand. That's what I don't get. Just make him captain again. Who cares?
But do you not think going from one captain who... is removed from the time of scandal to another captain removed in time of scandal.
All of that scandal and the way that it was handled has been of their own making. You know, they blew it up to be kind of like the crime of the century when in fact, you know, a couple of match ban and a big old fine would have done it. That's Cricket Australia. That's Australia, actually. That's kind of the Australian Parliament. That's the Australian public that have kind of caused that situation. I don't think anyone would give a monkey's outside of there if Steve Smith was made captain again. He's clearly the right bloke for the job. Just give it back to him.
There was always that idea that even when Payne was captain, Smith was pulling the strings. Although I felt sorry for Payne on that one, actually, because every time anything went right, it was Steve Smith. But any time it all went wrong, like Headingley, then it was definitely Payne's fault. So I felt that he was on a hiding to nothing. But I wonder if that will be the case, even if Cummins does get the job, whether Smith will be kind of not captain everything but name, but essentially a kind of a joint captain on the field, and Cummins does the off-field duties, which, you know, a hugely significant part of being a cricket captain these days. You think of the pressure that's been put on Joe Root over the last couple of years, how much of that is off the field compared to on the field?
Except I can imagine a situation whereby you start to resent that massively. I mean, and again, we're speculating wildly here as to how it's all going to play out. But if I was the captain who had to do all the shit jobs, but wasn't sort of really in charge of what was going on in the field, I wouldn't do that for very long. That would be like, well, sorry, mate, you go and do the press conferences because I've had a gutful of this.
Deal with the latest scandal.
Exactly.
I'll set the field.
Exactly. So, you know, I can't see that working at all.
Finally then, Taha, would you keep him in the side as wicketkeeper? Warne, Watts, Inglis, there's Alex Carey, Sam Whiteman, Matthew Wade's got a bit of an injury, but obviously got all the T20 World Cup runs.
I honestly haven't seen much of the others in terms of watching them play Red Bull cricket, so I haven't really got a clue. I don't think Tim Benn's done that bad a job as a keeper batter, so I thought he batted quite well against India. I thought he's batted all right in the last couple of years in Test cricket, basically, so... You know, he's still very much able to do the job. I think Australia's still okay there. I don't think he's that bad. Yeah, people don't rate him, but
given the same opportunities, Alex Carey would have made a hell of a lot more runs and more of an impact as a player. I'm pretty sure of that.
And I guess he's also a future captaincy candidate. Is Carey is how they see him,
yeah,
as well.
Potentially.
So
I think you want to start nurturing first. That. I remember the first time I saw him was over here. Was it in that? In the World Cup trial, because he got hit, Joffrey hit him, knocked his helmet off, didn't he? It was there, and I just thought, wow, this guy can really play. Glove work was decent. I think he's been kept out. He's been kept out of the team for 2 years, really, honestly.
So Payne has at least been moved on from the cover of video game Cricket 22, which had to be delayed until December the 2nd to accommodate Payne's resignation. Pat Cummins has replaced him on the cover, but that's only because he's his vice captain. That's not evidence of his promotion, also, we're told. I spoke to Mike Merrin, Director of Development at Big Ant Studios, about the game. Hi, Mike. Thanks very much for joining us. I suppose we should start with the big news of the week, which is that Cricket 22 has been delayed until December the 2nd. Do you want to fill us in on why?
No, I mean, obviously, it's been an interesting few days. I'm sure that the news has kind of filtered around about, you know, what's happened. So we're kind of... Just in the process of making sure that we get a game that's obviously as authentic as possible for release. So something that actually matches up with what the Ashes is going to be. And just to try and make sure that the public get, when they go out and they have that first ball of the Ashes when they're playing the game, the teams are as they should be. I'll probably say no more than that.
Yeah, well, I've noticed that the one of the more visible changes that has been made is that Tim Payne has obviously come off the cover and Pat Cummins has come on the cover, but we shouldn't take that as ultimate confirmation that Pat Cummins is Australia's next Test captain. That's just because he's vice captain and that's all that's there.
I mean, that's basically we've gone with, because obviously we don't know. No, nobody knows. I mean, I don't even know if the Australian selectors know just yet. So the most obvious choice in terms of, you know, vice captain is the one that you put on the front just to, you know, kind of cover everything off. And let's face it, he's a good looking guy.
Yeah, well, yeah, exactly. He's a good guy to have on the front cover video. It's a good point. So let's go back to the start of what was Don Bradman cricket at the time. And because cricket has a patchy history with video games overall, in that, you know, a lot of people love Brian Lara cricket, or I think Shane Warne cricket as it is in Australia. But there's not something sort of definitive like FIFA that people sort of seek out every year. What were you trying to sort of to make happen with Don Bradman cricket at the time and now with Cricket 22 that sort of sets it apart from other cricket games?
Yeah, I mean, look, the key thing back when we were doing Bradman, I mean, you've got to remember, when we first started to do the cricket game, we had no license. So, you know, Don Bradman was not even in our wildest dreams something that we would have had as a license for the game. I mean, we kind of joked about it in terms of what players you might have as the name of it, you know, like your Brian Laras and Shane Warne, and, you know, it's like Don Bradman. Yeah, right, of course. And to pick that up was amazing. But the key thing we did when we went for it was not thinking about the licenses. It was, how do you change how you play the game of cricket? Everything had always been that marker on the ground, and we wanted to try and make it so that it was the more authentic to the sport. So it's like, if you're a batsman or a batter, as we should say nowadays, the ball is your, you know, that's what you want to look at. So you want to look at it as it comes out of the hand of the bowler. So we put the marker effectively around the ball, and that kind of, you know, pretty much revolutionized how you kind of played the sport. Then it wasn't like, I've got to look at the ground where the ball's going to bounce immediately. I'm looking at where the ball's come from and then what it's going to do. And that, I thought, you know, at the time it revolutionized exactly what people wanted to see in the sport. And certainly from a hardcore fan point of view, that kind of people that like the sim side of it, it really, you know, kind of struck a chord, I think. As we've gone through now, I think 7 cricket games, I think it's the 7th one. Obviously, now we're kind of bringing more and more people into it. It's always been a bit of a niche sport in terms of computer games, and now we're getting a bigger audience. Obviously, we did Game Pass on Cricket 19, which kind of brought in a lot more casual players. So in Cricket 22, we're trying to make it a lot more accessible. So you've still got that sim side and those kind of controls, but now we're bringing back some of those, old school, more pick up and play kind of elements, so that if you're a bit more of a casual player, you can still, you know, you can still get in and enjoy the sport as well. So it's kind of trying to cater for those kind of both elements as it's kind of grown as a, I suppose the games we do has grown as a community.
Yeah, that's because when I played one of the earlier versions, I really liked how I could just sort of pick it up and have some sort of game straight away, while also knowing there were kind of intricacies that I wasn't fully appreciating that I'd get into more as I played more of it. What are the things that have kind of made it even more, I guess, beginner friendly in this version?
Yeah, I mean, look, one of the key things we've added is, for people that have never played a Big Ant game, we've got a much better first time user experience that we've added, which effectively takes you through all the controls and all the elements of, one, teaches you a bit about cricket as much as anything, and also how you you know, how you'll get the best out of the game in terms of how you bowl, how you bat. And that's all kind of there. If you've never played one of our games, that's the first thing that you'll be introduced to if you want to. If you know exactly what you're doing with a big ant cricket game, you can go in and choose the controls you like, and away you go, and then just play. So yeah, that's been the key thing, is kind of trying to cater for those people that, you know, might not necessarily be traditional kind of players of our games. I think we've learned as we've done the 7 games that, you know, being a bit unkind to ourselves, we probably made it quite hard for people to actually get into them. That kind of learning curve is, you know, certainly on the earlier ones, it's pretty tough. You know, we kind of go, here's the game, off you go. And you have to kind of find your own way, sort of, you know, thrown into the fire a little bit in terms of those earlier games. So that's really what we're trying to do, is kind of make sure that people get the most out of it now, in terms of kind of feeling like they may be floundering a little bit.
Yeah, okay. And what one of the features I noticed that's new or possibly expanded for this game is the career mode. Is that right? So what, try and sort of describe that. Is it, where are you starting from? Are you sort of a third 11 club cricketer sort of getting up to test cricket, or how does that work?
Yeah, so you start in a club cricket scenario, but we start you off again in terms of, this is to try and make sure that it's a little bit more accessible. You're coming in as probably one of those players that I suppose is a star player, but at a club level. Mm-hmm. So you come in, you're already kind of a little bit known. You've got some skills. It's not like you're bottom level, not knowing what you're doing. So you should be able to go into that club level and be, you know, a kind of a person that should be able to get, you know, the odd 20 or 30 runs, maybe even a half century, pretty quickly. If you're batting and, you know, getting wickets fairly early on. And so the idea is that we kind of bring you in, and again, you're not floundering at that level. Then as you progress, you might get the offer of a captaincy or progress to that, you know, the state side or county. That's when it starts to get that little bit more difficult, and you're kind of then trying to establish yourself in the team rather than being brought in as, hey, this is a guy that, you know, could make a difference to us as a club. And that's where you kind of start. And we've put cutscenes in there to kind of immerse you in that kind of scenario as well. So I'm not going to say it's a story mode, but it's definitely an immersive career that kind of, you know, takes you through what you're trying to do. Whereas our old ones were, you know, is a club cricket, play a match, next week, play a match, next week, play a match. This is, you know, it kind of takes you through, and there's now each week you might go and do gym sessions, and there's actually now gym mini games. So you do treadmill mini games, and there's yoga and all sorts of stuff. I think there's about 7 mini games that we've added there in terms of gym stuff that will allow you to increase your skills as you're playing. You've then got the net sessions that you do, which also increase skills. We've even got press conferences, man of the match awards, all those kind of things as you go through your career. They'll make a difference of whether you're going to, you know, how you answer some of the press conference things may make a difference to whether you become a captain, whether or not you're valued enough in the team to become captain.
And increasing skill levels, that in a way gives you sort of greater margin for error and reaction time when you're sort of facing the better bowlers that you get as you go through the games. Is that kind of the idea?
Yeah. So they're effectively you, the way the skills work is that you can only assign so many to certain areas of your batting or bowling. So you're going to have some weaknesses that you need to work on as you go through. You know, whether or not you're not great against spin, or you're not good back foot, or, you know, there'll be different things that you have to work on within your skills to try and build those up to make sure that the bowlers don't exploit your weaknesses.
Right, that's fascinating. And am I right in thinking that as lots of our listeners will be keen to hear and some will be dismayed, you added the 100 to this game, is that right?
Yes, yeah, the 100's in there. I, funny enough, I mean, it's obviously over in Australia, we had it on the TV, it was here, you know, shown, I think, pretty much every night that there was a game it was on. Mm-hmm. So it kind of for us, it felt like it was well received. Obviously, the Big Bash here is massive for the Big Bash League. So I think it was intriguing for us to see how the ECB have decided to kind of come out with something a bit new and experiment with the sport a little bit. Makes it interesting for us because from a computer game point of view and the AI, you've suddenly got another game mode, another style that you've got to try and work out how the tactics work and how the AI reacts to that. So, you know, I think I've talked before to people that there's not many sports games, in fact, I don't know any sports games that would go out and have AI that has to cope with 5-day test matches down to, you know, a 100 ball, but, you know, a 5 ball over scenario. We can't even call them overs now, is it? It's 5 balls.
Sets, they call them, I think, yeah.
Sets, that's it, sets. And, you know, it's that. So trying to deal with that and how you actually try and make it a fun game is an interesting sort of a thing we have to deal with. So yeah, they just threw another one in the mix. This time we've got the 100 there. We've also got CPL for the T20 tournaments for the West Indies, and we've got Big Bash, which is the Australian one.
That's fascinating. Okay, and because I think I remember reading that in the shorter formats as well, you've managed to tweak it so it is kind of easier to hit a six, but is that right, Martin?
Yeah, so there's effectively what we have is we've got a confidence element that's there. So basically, if you're going into a test match, those confidence levels will be basically tailored based on the fact that a red ball is likely to move more and all those kind of things. So you have to get yourself more settled at the crease. If you go into a test match and you start trying to whack the ball around, that's more likely that you're going to get an edge. The ball's moving more, and so that you have to be more cautious. When we go into those shorter form games, we effectively go, well, you're a Glenn Maxwell or trying to think of maybe a Johnny Bairstow or something that might just go in and you know, or Josh Butler, that they want to go in and they're pretty much looking for, you know, boundaries from the off. And so we kind of allow that kind of little bit of like confidence because they're going to the crease kind of going, this is what we're going to do. And so that means that it's a little easier for you to go for your shots from the beginning. You still have to be a bit cautious. Mm-hmm. But because obviously, again, the ball's not moving as much. So effectively the ball quality is, there's a number to do with the ball quality that will effectively, if that number's high because the delivery from the bowler is a good delivery. So if it's got, you know, movement, or maybe it's even going to hit some, you know, a crack on the pitch and things like that, those things will add up and affect your likelihood of being able to hit a good shot based on, again, as I said, timing, shot choice, and footwork. They're kind of the three key things from a batter point of view. If you get those three things right, then the delivery from the bowler has to be exceptional for you then to get out, essentially.
Yeah.
So, but there is still a chance that you could. There's, you know, sometimes there's going to be deliveries that doesn't matter. You know, they, you know, you're going to get the odd jaffer that just gets you, and that's it.
Yeah. So it's interesting because obviously you talked at the beginning about how you've made this game in particular more accessible. I feel like fans of or listeners of this podcast will who will be mostly cricket badgers will just be like it feels like you guys who've made the game are all sort of cricket nuts yourself basically and have tried to make something that like as closely assimilates cricket as possible while it's still done with the controller. So all the factors that come into play while you're playing cricket, those should somehow influence how you play the game. Is that sort of fair?
Yeah, that is fair. I mean, you know, it's everything comes, you know, from the weather. Is it cloudy? Is it not? You know, we've even got things like humidity in the air that affects whether or not clouds come in and things like that. So, you know, wind will affect things. So all these little nuances that are there, you know, add up to, you know, as I say, the key thing is, as a player, you've got to make a choice on if you think what's being bowled at you needs to be defended against or whether you can hit, you know, go for it and hit a six. And you've got to, you know, pretty much a split second decision to make your mind up on some of those.
Cricket 22 is out on Thursday, December the 2nd on PlayStation 4 and 5, Xbox One and Series X/S and PC. The latest from Big Ant, the biggest name in cricket simulations, Cricket 22 gives you unprecedented depth with new controls, gameplay, a narrative-driven career mode, a new commentary team, and all new team and competition licenses. Play along with this year's Ashes competition, take part in the 100, or move through the ranks to represent your nation at the highest level. Cricket 22 has it all, and remember, it is out very, very soon. In other Ashes news, Bryden Carr has been ruled out of the Lions tour with a knee injury, which is potentially quite an important development for England, Joe. He was one of those few bowlers in that backup squad with the kind of pace who could come in and make a difference, possibly. On other Ashes developments, England have begun their first of two warm-up games against England Lions, but after a bit of rain, Haseeb Mahmood has made his way to 53 not out, Joe, which is potentially significant.
It is, yeah. We've talked about how these couple of warm-up games are potentially kind of a playoff between Crawley and Hamid to open alongside Burns. I think you could even read into the fact that Hamid is opening, that he's kind of in pole position at this point, which I think he should be. I know there's a lot of talk about his technique and how he'll go against the quicks in Australia, and that Crawley might potentially be more suited to that. But I think to go with Crawley, who's barely made a run for a year, over Hamid, who's been in good nick, just come back into the side based on something that may or may not happen, doesn't make any sense to me. I mean, I know his record against pace is not good over his career, but players also do rise to the occasion. If we do think Hamid is potentially a proper test match opener of real class, you can do this in the long run, then you don't pick and choose the series that you play him. You play him and see how he goes. And if it doesn't work out, so be it. But I think he absolutely deserves that chance, and it's good to see him making some runs. I have to say, I've just seen a scorecard. He might have been dropped 8 times. He might have played terribly, but anyway, he's got some runs. He's 50 not out, and yeah, I think that is a significant in a bit of a. These games are not going to be hugely competitive just by the very nature of them, but that's a significant innings to kick off the tour. The other one that will be interesting to see tomorrow is Ollie Pope. Bairstow's not playing because the T20 World Cup players are still in quarantine. There's some suggestions that Bairstow might be ahead of Pope in the pecking order, in that Bairstow was apparently lined up to play that final test against India before it got cancelled above Pope, which to me is madness. And if that is the way they were thinking at that stage, they could see Bairstow's century out there last time and think he's the player. I think that would be an entirely wrong-headed decision. So I really hope Pope gets some runs as well and nails down that spot because, yeah, he should be batting six in this England side.
Yeah, I mean, the last time Ollie Pope played in similar conditions was the South Africa trip, wasn't it? And he played magnificently down there. You know, it's a place where there is much less lateral movement, where that whole argument around off-stump guards and all the rest of it make less of a difference. Ball isn't moving sideways, isn't swinging, isn't going to move off the seam, and he's a damn good player. So there you go.
And as Ben's pointed out before on this podcast, he's a player who, once he gets in, makes big scores in county cricket. At least we haven't seen that in Test cricket yet, but that is something that's going to be invaluable in Australia, that once you get in, you stay in and you bat for a long, long time.
Yeah, the other thing I'm mentioning is Ben Stokes' card to come in at 5 tomorrow, his first sort of semi-competitive hit since returning. And the other thing on Hamid as well is just that, you know, that Australia pitchers have this reputation of, you know, being, you know, lightning quick, you know, bouncing from a length up over your head and that sort of thing. But that's not really what they've been like for quite a long time. Like actually, they can be quite slow and low, or at least just sort of like moderately paced. And actually, you know, this worry that, you know, Hamid's going to have to, like, not going to be able to get on the front foot at all, and is going to have to play everything up around his eyes is a bit of an over-exaggeration, I think.
And I don't see that being a massive problem for him either.
Do you think there's been too much made of that?
Yep.
Fair enough. Joe, your moment of the week.
My moment of the week was AB de Villiers retiring, which oddly sort of took me by surprise slightly. I just thought he would play T20 forever, like Chris Gayle. But he's talked in the past about kind of getting a bit worn out by the game at different points, and he kind of alluded to that in his tweet. I played the game with pure enjoyment and unbridled enthusiasm. Now, at the age of 37, that flame no longer burns so brightly. So, you know, fair enough. He's done his bit, but I think it took me by surprise partly because it's always seemed to me there's a kind of agelessness to him, partly because the way he plays is so modern, or kind of even still now kind of ahead of the curve in some ways. But also just because his skill level just has hardly dropped at all. You just feel like he could carry on for as long as he wanted. Which I guess he has.
Well, he has, yeah. But I was going to say that it came as a surprise to me because I'd already thought he'd retired. You know what I mean?
I can see why it came as a surprise.
But playing T20 cricket only really feels like retirement to me anyway. You know what I mean? Yeah. That's kind of like that. You're not really doing the gig there. You're just kind of you're floating around. You're smashing a few.
I felt the same way. Sorry.
Yeah. No. Yeah. I'm with you, Taha. Good.
Because it felt like for me it was kind of. So he obviously retired from international cricket 3 years ago, but there was always that kind of, oh, will he, won't he come back? And that was kind of the thing where it's like, oh, he's got one last kind of World Cup or something in him. And when they kind of said, there's not going to be any more World Cups, that kind of thing, that kind of felt like, okay, that's the end. And I haven't really, you know, I haven't really paid that close attention to him since that, basically, just because it kind of, that felt like the chapter was closed, basically.
Sure, but even in that kind of state of semi-retirement, he still plays just the odd unbelievable innings in the IPL, or more than the odd innings, but... And it also struck me when he retired, you see this even during his career, like the reverence that his contemporaries have for him, and not just like, oh, he's a really good player, but they hold him in a kind of awe. And you see that with even Kohli, who's basically kind of a fanboy of his. And I think there are very few cricketers in my lifetime that have had that kind of effect on their colleagues, on their opponents and their teammates. I think like maybe Lara, Tendulkar, but not many who play other players who can do extraordinary things themselves, just like this guy is unbelievable. And you see that when they're watching him on the sidelines and he pulls off a shot that is just kind of scarcely believable, and you see the expression on their face, and that's something that I find stunning, that you can be a sportsman at the very top of your game playing at the elite level and still see someone that blows you away. And there's very few players I think who fall into that category.
Yeah, I think a lot of those current, you know, those England white ball guys who all play that certain way, a lot of them talked about de Villiers as that one guy who was sort of on another level.
And I was going to say, Butch, obviously, I was looking back, I was thinking, they must have played together and you just overlapped. So
we did overlap.
Your penultimate test match was his test debut.
Durban, yeah. Is that right? Durban?
Yeah. Or Centurion.
Was it?
So he opened the batting on debut.
Did he?
And okay. Then he got
obviously left an indelible wicket. Mark on me.
Then he kept wicket and was batting at 7, where he scored a half century.
Okay.
In what would have been your
See, one of my favourite moments post career actually involves AB de Villiers, and I apologise to him if I'm talking in any way out of turn, but it was one of my jaunts to the IPL with Sky Sports back in, I might have been 2015 or 2016, and I was roving reporter, and we were staying in Bangalore, obviously he's playing for RCB, and we had a bit of a you know, we met up and had a drink sort of late into the night after one of the RCB games, and walking back to the hotel with AB, and he said to me, completely unsolicited, he said it's so nice to have a drink with you, Bush. I said, oh, that's nice, mate. It's good to see you too. He said, when I was in the backyard the youngsters. He said, my brother's back at home. He said, I used to be Mark Butcher, he said. And I just looked at him like, how many beers have you had? Like, type thing. And I kind of remember going out and thinking, he actually bloody said that. It's utterly ridiculous. I said he probably could have batted better than me left-handed if he wanted to. So
he's not one of those that's got you confused with Mark Boucher.
Yeah, maybe he is as well. Yeah, maybe it was that late in the night. But yeah, no, the most extraordinary thing. So there you go. Cheers, AB.
Was he one of those players that, I mean, you couldn't really remember playing alongside him in debut, but was he one of those players that as soon as you saw him, you were like, this guy is special? Or did that develop over?
Not at all. He came with a huge, huge reputation at the time. It was kind of like, you know, everyone in South Africa was talking about this kid. Now he's going to, you know, he runs a sub 10 second 100 meters and can play tennis and swims like a fish and all the rest. He's just like this. Exactly. All of that sort of stuff. So we were all quite keen to kind of keen to send him back without any runs or whatever, as you try to ruin youngsters when they come into opposition teams against you, which is exactly the way that it should be. And then, by 2015, 16, whenever it was, when I was out in India, he was a megastar by then. So I'd sort of seen his career from afar. Remember that incredible World Cup, was it 2015, wasn't it, when he just...
He averaged about 95, his strike rate was like 150, I think.
Yeah, it was just unbelievable. And there was, and it sparked off all those ridiculous conversations about size of bats and grounds and all that kind of stuff. And I'm just like, for Christ's sake, people, just watch this guy and enjoy genius when you're watching it, you know. Sometimes bowling attacks aren't good enough to compete with guys like this. And if it was all about the bats, then everybody would be doing what he does, and nobody did.
Taha, your moment of the week?
My moment was the sort of announcement of Pakistan hosting the 2025 Champions Trophy. They haven't hosted a tournament since the 96 World Cup. They were sort of meant to co-host the 2011 one, but lost that to security concerns. And, you know, it's just great news. Country that's constantly has this battle over hosting cricket, has done for pretty much this whole century. You know, you've got the recent blows when New Zealand pulled out and the ECB did their thing. So just quite a nice boost. I hope it happens. Fingers crossed it happens. A lot can, you know, Australia meant to tour next March and you still hope that happens. So, you know, looking ahead to 4 years, you don't really know what's going to happen. But yeah, I thought that was just a nice little thing.
And there's obviously the murmurings that you'd expect in India of, oh, are we going to go? I'm not sure we'll go. Who knows how that will play out. But I think it's kind of uncharacteristically brave on the ICC's part to have given Pakistan this tournament, because they will have known exactly what the reaction would be in India. And the ICC often suffer accusations that they will just go along with whatever India want, because they, in many ways, kind of dominate the game in terms of their kind of financial clout and the IPL and all the other bits that come along with Indian cricket. So it's good to see the ICC actually doing what is right, and it is Pakistan's turn, and it's absolutely right that they should be able to host these kind of tournaments.
And there's got to be kind of a respect for what the PCB have done for the last few years, that the sort of the efforts they go through to, you know, to have people come over, the sort of security that teams are provided with. And also kind of, you know, with Ramiz Raja coming in as chair, you know, he's not going to back down. And he's kind of, you know, when New Zealand pulled out, when England pulled out, he, you know, he questioned it and he was public with it. And I just feel like, you know, you kind of need that. You kind of need someone there to be like, well, look, we're doing everything. There's kind of almost no reason for us to not be hosting events or hosting international countries, you know.
And I know it didn't work out on the end of the T20 World Cup, but it feels like there's a real buzz around Pakistani cricket at the moment. Obviously, the fans are always on board, but actually around the whole thing, Ramiz Raja was also talking about them wanting to be the basically do a women's PSL, which if they beat the IPL to the punch after all the kind of posturing over that for a few years, that would be quite a thing in itself as well. Ramiz Raja obviously is... He wants to get things done and he's going to say what he thinks and he's not just going to kind of toe the line. And he seems to be making quite an impact already. And also you should probably credit Wazim Khan for the job he did whilst he was there as well. they've had some strong personalities, some good people in high positions, and it's having an effect.
I guess India can't be too disheartened by the announcement, considering how much cricket they are going to be hosting. So they're going to host, I think, 4 global tournaments in 8 years. So, and also there are just so many tournaments. So India have got the 2023 World Cup, 2026 T20 World Cup, 2029 Champions Trophy, and 2031 World Cup. And there is a global event every year from this year until 2031, and then who knows what's going to happen. So it makes such a challenge for teams who have to sort of regenerate and bring in new players. There is no time to sort of take stock and plan for the next event, because the next event is always at most sort of 18 months away. But let's get on finally, I suppose, to some of the actual cricket that was played and that we watched this week. India beat New Zealand 3-0 in a T20I series. New Zealand looked exhausted and kind of like they didn't want to be there, which they probably didn't. Rohit Sharma scored lots of runs and R. Ashwin bowled well. I'm not sure how much more there is to say about the series. I know it was discussed a bit last week, but I'm looking forward to the tests. Kara Hall has been reportedly ruled out with first test with injury, which means that for the first game, India will be without Rohit Sharma, Kara Hall, Rishabh Pant, Virat Kohli, Jasprit Bumrah and Mohammad Shami. New Zealand should be licking their lips, right, Butch?
Yeah, they should be. I mean, those guys have been on the road for a long old time, and they're kind of, as you said, they were less than enthusiastic, or just, you know, they didn't have enough petrol in the tank to kind of get themselves up for more 2020 after another disappointment in a world final. But they're very proudly world test champions, and we'll be looking, I'm sure they'll be 100% at India, and also looking at them thinking, well, you know, no Rohit at the top of the order, that's huge for any visiting side. However, it does throw up the tantalising prospect of some of the undercard of India's batting getting a chance to showcase itself, because boy, those guys, they have to make some runs, and it looks as though they're never going to play, doesn't it? I mean, Ajinkya Rahane keeps his place in the side because he's going to be captain, but people like Shreyas Iyer and Shubman Gill will be back in the side. Suryakumar Yadav perhaps might find his way into the team. So there are a lot of very, very good young players, and they're not so young now, who have had to wait a long time to get a chance. What better time to do it? You do it against opposition who are very, very highly rated. You're at home yourselves. And you try to take the opportunity to keep some of the old boys out of the team.
Mm. Sri Lanka and West Indies have just begun their test series. Dimuth Kurinaratne hit 100 on day one. He averages more than 60 in tests since the start of 2020, and his past five scores read 75, 244, 118, 66 and 147, which is quite good. An incident on the first day with West Indies debutant Jeremy Solazano hospitalised after blow on the head at short leg. Scans have shown no structural damage, which is good, but he's been replaced by Shai Hope, a debut to forget, I guess. The Women's World Cup qualifier is underway. There have been a few positive COVID tests in a couple of camps, so fingers crossed that can all proceed, but it seems like Sri Lanka had the most cases and they are playing their first game at the moment. And we had a sizable shock with Bangladesh beating Pakistan. Rumana Ahmed, who's a gun cricketer, hit an unbeaten 50 as Bangladesh hit 42 off the last 4.5 overs to chase down just over 200. That could be quite a significant result. Pakistan beat Bangladesh 3-0 in a 3-match T20I series, which is again broadly pointless, but it did include my moment of the week at the end of the third game. Pakistan made a bit of a meal of a low chase, but needed 8 to win off the last. Mahmudullah, the captain, brings himself on for his first bowl of the game, takes 3 wickets and 5 balls, but concedes a 6, so it's 2 needed off 1. Then Mohammad Nawaz is in to face his first ball. He looks ready to face, but Mahmudullah sort of catches him a bit off guard by bowling it from behind the stumps, as, you know, lots of cricketers do. Nawaz just sort of like pulls out of his stance just about after the ball is pitched, lets it just smash into his stumps. And so you think, I mean, that Bangladesh should have won that. I mean, but the umpire says he has to re-bowl it, and Nawaz drives it through the covers for 4. So I was fuming, and no one else was watching, I think.
Ben, we've got conjoining officers here, and Ben stuck his head through the door to tell us in a state of high excitement what was going on, and we just ushered him out. We're in the
Anyway, that's it for today's show. Thanks very much for listening. And if you have enjoyed listening, please tell your friends, subscribe and listen, and leave us a nice, maybe even a 5-star review on the app of your choice. Cheers.
Social Podcast Network.